Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is on your holiday season to-do list? Many of us look for a good movie or several to provide a respite from weeks spent cooking, hosting, visiting, and shopping. And studios are eager to reward us by saving some of their best releases for the final weeks of the year. Joining us to talk about their personal picks for the season are movie critics Chris Wagner, who writes for the Dallas Morning News, and Stephen Becker, who's on staff with KERA's Art and Seek. As you may also know, they are co-hosts of the weekly podcast, The Big Screen, which you can download for free at artandseek.net. Stephen, Chris, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris, good to see you.
Okay, I want to start out with a nod to all the Tolkien fans out there. How successfully does The Hobbit tell this story that is so dear to generations of readers?
We haven't seen it yet. So
it still remains to be seen, but you know, they are going to really take their time with it because I believe they're doing it in either two or three parts.
I hear three.
So you'll basically be able to read The Hobbit in the time it takes you to watch The Hobbit. But it's smart on their part because, as everyone knows, you know, the original trilogy of The Lord of the Rings made, you know, $1 jillion worldwide. So if you can cut The Hobbit up into multiple parts and get that money every time, I mean, it's like, why wouldn't you do it?
And it's got the Peter Jackson pedigree, so you certainly expect at least high production value out of it. So I'm looking forward to seeing it. I will admit, you may crucify me if you want, that I have not read The Hobbit. I will have to do some Hobbit cramming between now and then.
I'm not sure that's even legal to talk about, according to the FCC.
Well, I read The Hobbit, and so I'm looking forward to the movie. I'm not as, you know, a huge Lord of the Rings fan like so many people are just passionate about those stories. I have to admit, when I think of those movies, I think of the way Kevin Smith, who's the director, who's also a big Star Wars fan, he likes to defend the Star Wars trilogy as being the trilogy. He doesn't like it when Lord of the Rings fans refer to that as the trilogy, but he also likes to say that the Lord of the Rings movies are basically three movies about guys walking around. And I think there's a certain amount of truth to that.
You know, as long as Jar Jar Binks isn't in The Hobbit.
I don't think he will be. Wow, that would be something.
I'll be very happy.
So you may not be, Stephen, a giant Lord of the Rings fan, but I guess the novels that you care about seeing on screen are the Twilight series.
Yes,
am I correct
clearly
about that?
Yeah, that's what I really couldn't wait. You know, this is actually, you mentioned novels on screen, but this is a really good year four novels on screen. Chris and I both enjoyed the Anna Karenina adaptation that came out a few weeks ago, starring Keira Knightley. Silver Linings Playbook is another one that I'm sure we're going to talk about eventually. That's a novel that made the transition. So this is kind of the time when those sort of movies come out anyway, you know, because they have this a little bit of prestige behind them. So that's why we put them at the end of the year.
Because
there's a ton of them this year.
Because Hollywood really doesn't have that many ideas of its own.
So yeah, it's,
books come in very handy.
When you see an original, a truly original screenplay, it kind of makes you step back like, wow, I don't actually know this story already.
What did you like about Anna Karenina?
I actually, the stage conceit worked for me. Some critics didn't like it. The whole thing is kind of set on, at least many of the key sequences are set as part of a stage play. So you see characters walking by stagehands and pulling ropes and extras in the background. And I guess it's kind of a forced metaphor for, you know, what life in this particular 19th century Russian strata was like, that it's, everybody has a part to play. I just thought it worked visually as much as anything. And I like Keira Knightley. She's kind of gotten bashed in some circles. She's a very sort of modern, untragic Anna Karenina. She's headstrong. She makes her own decisions. She makes her bed and sleeps in it. And of course, it doesn't end well for her as it doesn't in the novel. But it just seemed modern to me.
It's also just about the most highly choreographed movie you're likely to see. It really moves very beautifully. It's almost like as if you're watching a ballet. You know, Chris said it takes place almost entirely in this theater. And the movements, it's hard to describe, but the movements of the characters, they will just so, it's these really upper crust, you know, Russians back, as you said. And they'll just be walking through a scene and their little yes men, you know, will like put their coats on them and hand them their cups of tea as they're moving. And it really kind of underscores the idea of these people who never really had to even want for anything because they had these, you know, little servants to do everything for them.
But they don't do it like a story within a story. It's not like French Lieutenant's Woman or something like that.
No, it's more, I think it's more seamlessly weaved in. And then the secondary subplot, the secondary love story actually doesn't take place on the stage. It takes place in fields of wheat, as Woody Allen would say, in Love and Death. So it has some of that, you know, lush Russian, you know, scenery, although it's not Russia.
Yeah, actually. And there are times where people will walk out of the stage door and then all of a sudden they're like in the middle of a field, like you said. So you have to suspend your disbelief a little bit.
It sounds cool. Actually, I'm more interested to see it now than I was before. I have to say, I sort of have plans on Christmas afternoon to see the adaptation of Les Mis, which I know it's been done on film before. I liked the earlier film adaptations. Does it work as a movie musical?
Once again, we have not seen it yet.
What do you think? What's your sense?
Well, it's getting crazy Oscar buzz. It's getting buzz as the front runner at this point, the movie that all others have to beat. There was a column, I think it was in Huffington Post the other day, that I thought might have been an Onion story, but it wasn't. It was by a veteran Hollywood producer who said, "This might be the best movie I've ever seen."
Wow.
Which kind of makes you raise your eyebrows and say, "Huh, well, it's probably pretty good then, even if it's not ends up not being the best movie that I've ever seen." It's got a great cast, Hugh Jackman, Russell Crowe, Anne Hathaway. So everything I hear is that it's epic in a good way. We actually just talked to Judd Apatow this morning. He's a big fan of
Les Mis.
He's actually seen it. And
yes.
He was saying that it's just on a really, I can't believe we're like relaying Judd Apatow's, you know, review of Les Mis. But whatever, it's what we have to go on, right?
My connection to fame and fortune.
But he was just saying it's really on an epic scale, kind of unlike the example he used with Chicago, which, you know, really shows all of its theatrical backbones and the way it takes place, really kind of on a stage with black screens and stuff. He said this is all just, you know, big, huge French scenery, and that they really went for it on an epic scale, which this isn't. I mean, it's an epic musical, so I'm looking forward to seeing how they really play this thing really big.
Yeah, some of these movies we're going to be seeing in the next couple of weeks. I promise we'll get to one that we've
seen,
though.
We actually do see movies, yes. Believe it or not.
The interesting thing I read about the Les Mis movie is that they actually recorded the audio for the singing as they were doing the scenes. And for people who don't know how this is normally done, that's very uncommon, right? Normally they act out the scene and kind of lip sync, and then they go into a sound studio where everything is pristine.
That certainly sounds like it will make it feel more spontaneous, at least. Hugh Jackman, I know, can carry that kind of thing off, having done Broadway and done a good job hosting the Oscars a few years ago. He certainly has some musical genes in him. Russell Crowe has a rock band, so maybe that'll help him out as well.
Well, and I think the way that may help is that in the moment, as these characters or these actors are singing the songs, you may act a different way than when it is that you're just in some cold studio recording it. So I'll be interested to see how that plays off. They certainly got good singers to be in the movie. I mean, I think we've all seen Anne Hathaway sing before. Hugh Jackman certainly has the skins on the wall. So, I mean, the casting seems pretty spot on from what I can tell.
Okay, I've been interested in The Impossible since I saw a trailer this past summer. Have you guys seen that?
I have seen it, actually.
All right. Okay. I know it'll be great for the special effects. As a parent of four kids, it made me cry just watching the two-minute trailer. What'd you think?
Naomi Watts is outstanding. She's probably going to get nominated for an Oscar for it. She just carries off a panicked, bereaved parent extremely well. She spends half the movie lying in a hospital bed, looking very un-Naomi Watts-like, for those of us who have seen Naomi Watts before. The tsunami stuff is very well done. It gets a little bit treacly. There's a tiny bit of a movie of the week quality to it, but it's certainly engaging, and Naomi Watts is a really riveting emotional core for the film. Ewan McGregor doesn't really have all that much to do except wander around and look for his children. Basically, two parents and their kids get stuck in the tsunami, 2004 tsunami. And they all get separated, and they have to try to reconnect. It is a Hollywood movie. You can probably guess how it ends. It's not bad, and Naomi Watts is really, really good.
One early criticism I read was that it focuses on this sort of white family visiting the destruction, as opposed to the, you know, thousands upon thousands of residents of those areas. Did you have that sense? Did it make you uncomfortable for that reason?
I think that's a reasonable criticism. It didn't particularly bother me. But yeah, I mean, that's the way these movies often work. You kind of feel like producers, studios feel like they need white stars to help sell the movie and, you know, to have marketable faces up there as much as anything else. So, yeah, I think that's a legit criticism. Like I said, it didn't really bother me personally that much.
Oh, I was just going to say, this time of year for people like Chris and I, if you're in some of these critics associations like we are, every trip out to the mailbox is kind of like Christmas because we start to get some of these screeners in. And I have not seen The Impossible yet, but that's the one that showed up yesterday. So that was nice to tear open that package and see that. So I will be seeing that this weekend, I believe.
Awesome. Now, critics associations, are there conferences where like everybody shows up and complains about the food? Or how do you communicate with other critics?
That would be way more fun than what actually happens. We vote on best movie, best performance, things like that at the end of the year, and we get screeners in the mail. That's the best thing about it. We actually get the Academy screeners. We are nowhere near even sniffing voting for Academy Awards, of course, as members of the press. But the studios want to get us those movies largely so we can give them top 10 consideration at the end of the year. And it helps, frankly, be able to see a movie more than once.
Okay, so a lot of people are talking about Daniel Day-Lewis's potential for an Oscar. Having seen Lincoln, what did you guys think?
Oh, he's fantastic. I mean, there's no question. As I like to joke, it's Abraham Lincoln playing Daniel Day-Lewis. It's uncanny. I mean, you look at him and you just get lost in what's going on, and it's kind of part and parcel for the rest of the film. It really feels kind of – I talked to Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote Team of Rivals, the book that this movie is partially based on, and she said she didn't really feel like she was watching a movie. She just felt like she was there watching these things happen. So – I would say he's the favorite for best actor at this point.
I think if there's one thing standing in his way, and this really shouldn't be taken as a criticism of his performance, but that it's not very showy, which is probably very true to Lincoln. You know, one of the reasons that Lincoln was a successful politician is he was able to kind of stay one step removed from all the muck, you know, and Daniel Day-Lewis certainly does this in this movie. And there aren't many scenes of him just, you know, yelling at underlings or pounding his fist on the table. You know, he does, because that's not the way he governed. And so his performance is very true to Lincoln as a person. But sometimes the roles that win people Oscars are more like his role in There Will Be Blood, where he has lots of big yelling and screaming scenes.
I've abandoned my boy.
Yeah, people associate that with acting in quotes.
That was good, though.
He was amazing in that. But subtler performances sometimes are more difficult to grab people by the lapels and say, hey, really look at this performance.
But so, I would also say he has a couple of scenes where he does unleash that fury. And it's just so jarring when he does it, the scenes where he's really demanding and arguing for the passage of the amendment, of the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. And then when those scenes come, I think there's two of them in particular, where he's talking to his cabinet, they have almost a sort of a biblical power to them, like, I am Abraham Lincoln and you will do what I say. So there aren't a lot of those scenes, but the ones that are there really hit home.
How's Sally feel?
I think she's great. I think it's kind of a part just made for her, Mary Todd, like a little bit crazy, very unhappy, loud. And I'm not saying any of this in a derogatory way. I think it's a great Sally Field part. I think she's going to get nominated as well.
I think she is too. But I think it's also in a way kind of a thankless role because she's not a – it's tough because she doesn't come off as a very likable character.
Right.
But, you know, she certainly brings to it, I think, what some other people wouldn't be able to.
Stephen Becker is here from KERA's Art and Seek, along with Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News. They are co-hosts of the weekly podcast, The Big Screen, which you can download for free at artandseek.net. We'll talk more about movies this holiday season in just a couple of minutes, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News and Stephen Becker of KERA's Art and Seek. Together, they co-host the weekly podcast, The Big Screen, which you can download at artandseek.net. We're talking this afternoon about holiday movies now and coming up within the next couple of weeks. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. Okay, so Silver Linings Playbook really intrigues me. I have not seen it, but this is like a sort of breakout for Bradley Cooper, right? He's not playing the guy from The Hangover, and it's comedy, but it's meatier. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Bradley Cooper's had a great year. He has really kind of expanded beyond that Hangover role with movies like this. And he plays a guy who is trying to get over the breakup of his marriage. He's recently out of a mental institution, and he's just kind of trying to find his way. And he doesn't have a lot of help from his family, who are very nurturing but also have their own problems, including his father, Robert De Niro, who is a little bit of a OCD, excessive gambler. And he's obsessed with trying to win his wife back. In the process, he meets a woman named Tiffany, who's played by Jennifer Lawrence. And it's kind of one of those, I'm falling in love and I don't even really realize that it's happening to me because I'm so obsessed with this other thing. So, yeah, it's a comedy, but a comedy that has a lot of substance to it.
It's also one of those films that, you know, kind of reaffirms that movies aren't made on paper because, I mean, Stephen, the very good plot summary there. That sounds kind of like standard fare. A guy gets out of mental institution, meets girl.
Sounds wacky.
They have a dance. Then there's a dance contest at the end. I think this is a great movie largely because of the direction. It's David O. Russell, who made The Fighter a couple of years ago. He just directs this movie with so much energy, and it kind of spreads to all of the actors. There's this sort of sense of controlled chaos throughout the whole film, and it's a really tricky tone. I mean, it is a comedy about mentally unbalanced people. It's also can be very serious. And to me, it ends up being very life-affirming. I responded emotionally to Silver Linings Playbook probably more than any other film I've seen this year. I really enjoy it. Highly recommend it. I think De Niro is really kind of a revelation because he's been coasting in movies for the last, I would say, 10, 12 years. He's been doing the Meet the Fockers movies. This is sort of a much more lived-in and passionate and engaged variation on that character of the sort of, I don't know, bemused, troubled father figure. There's a lot more meat on the bones of this performance. I think he's going to get a nomination for Best Supporting Actor.
I think he's known for playing characters that are very big, not necessarily physically, but just, you know, their outsized personalities. They're large in stature. Even in those Meet the Fockers movies, you know, he like is hovering over the intimidating guy. In this role, he almost plays a very small character. And, you know, that just is a testament to his ability as an actor to, you know, when you're known for being one way and to be able to completely do something else very believably. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I'm not the first person to say Robert De Niro is a good actor, but he really is exceptional in this movie.
I just haven't seen him look this interested in a part or in a movie for a long, long time.
Well, it's because he's not being asked to do the same thing that he's done 5 million times on screen. I think that's probably charged him up a little bit.
I think De Niro can call his own shots to a large extent. I think he picks a lot of projects that just aren't up to his ability. I don't know. I don't know the man personally. I just know that I've seen a lot of movies that he's been in over the last 10 years or so that don't seem worthy of his talents.
As we say often on the podcast, though, everybody's got to eat.
I don't think Mr. De Niro is starving at this point.
Jennifer Lawrence, that was Katniss Everdeen from Hunger Games. I think of her as a teenager. Does she play a convincing adult in this movie so that it's not creepy?
Yeah, she plays a convincing young adult, somebody in her early 20s, maybe early mid-20s, and she's fantastic. I think as much as De Niro, she's the heart of this movie. She has a real sort of fire and ice thing going at one moment. She seems sort of like a fragile, damaged character, and then she's exploding in rage, and then she's sassy. She has an amazing range in this movie. I know we're going to probably do an Oscar show later. We shouldn't get bogged down in Oscar talk, but that's my favorite female performance of the year.
She was, I think the original kind of knock on her was that maybe she was too young for the role, as you mentioned. But because her character has gone through a lot of things, and it's like, well, would somebody this young have gone through all of these things? But she, I mean, I thought was very convincing. And I liked her. I mean, she seemed very realistic because she would have these outbursts and then she would kind of be down on herself. And it just all seemed very real.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone to Jane in Dallas. Hey, Jane.
Hey, Chris. I want to recommend a movie that probably most people wouldn't even think of to really go see, but The Sessions. I just thought it was outstanding, and the surprise to me was I actually went to school at UC Berkeley with Mark O'Brien, the actual, you know, character, and the actor who played him nailed his voice so much. I was like, oh my God, that's Mark, you know, and it's, you know, it's about a person who is severely disabled, but wants to experience his sexuality and wants to have love and intimacy. And I thought it was done with such dignity and care and kindness. I just, it's a movie that a lot of people would think that's not worth seeing, but I just think that if you step out of your box, and that it is another life-affirming movie.
Well, great insights. Thank you so much for your call, Jane. Did you guys like that film?
Yeah, it's a great
film.
We did. John Hawkes is fantastic as Mark O'Brien, a character who actually has to spend most of his time in an iron lung. And he has to, he doesn't have to, but he seeks a sex surrogate played by Helen Hunt. And yeah, I agree with the caller. I also went to UC Berkeley, by the way. Go Bears. It's just a great look at intimacy. I think that's one of the words that she just used, actually, not just from the perspective of Mark O'Brien, the character played by John Hawkes, but Helen Hunt, you know, this woman who works as a sex surrogate and what that means to her psyche, her own marriage. Her emotions and this bond that these two characters form. Yeah, it's a great film.
And, you know, more kudos, like you said, to John Hawkes, who really, I mean, the only thing that he has as an actor to use is essentially his voice, because he spends the entire movie laying down with his head turned to one side. I mean, you can only do so much with that, and the way that he's really able to convey complex emotions, I mean, was just, it's really kind of a masterclass in acting.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. True or false, Skyfall is good even for those of us who are not that into James Bond.
I'd say true, because I'm not that into James Bond, and I really like Skyfall. I lost interest in the series years ago. I did like Casino Royale, the first Daniel Craig James Bond movie, and I liked it for similar reasons why I like Skyfall. It feels like it transcends what I think is sort of a adolescent action genre. And I think that's why a lot of people like the series, because it is rather inconsequential. But to me, those two movies, Casino Royale and now Skyfall, are really bringing in some more mature themes and ideas. They're honoring the franchise in ways that fans will appreciate. But I also think they have a lot to offer for those of us who are not big 007 fans.
As you said, not to get too bogged down in Oscar talk, but I really think Skyfall has an outside chance of winning a Best Picture nomination, especially considering there will be as many as 10 films nominated this year. Javier Bardem is maybe the best Bond villain yet. He plays another one of these kind of crazy, you know, Bond villains, but in a very, I don't want to give too much away for people who haven't seen it, but it's a Bond villain unlike Bond villains you've seen before. And, you know, you mentioned Casino Royale, Chris. I think when Daniel Craig took over the role, he's a serious enough actor that I think he wasn't just going to play Bond like, you know, some of his predecessors had. I think there was an understanding and expectation that this role and this franchise needed to get a little bit more depth to it that wasn't there.
Yeah, it needed a kick in the butt.
Yeah, and he, I think, not only brings that in his performances, but I think demands it from the script. And I mean, there's a reason why they hire people like Sam Mendes, who directed Skyfall. You know, you would have never seen a director like that direct some of these Bond movies from the 80s and 90s. And, you know, when you bring that talented team together, that's when you get more quality fare like this.
It's also become one of those franchises that the great English actors just flock to. Albert Finney is in this movie. Judi Dench, of course, is back as M.
Ralph Fiennes.
Ralph Fiennes is in this movie. Ben Whishaw. So in sort of like, in that sense, I kind of liken it, although it's so different from the Harry Potter movies. It's a magnet for great English acting, and you have to love that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Todd in Dallas. Hey, Todd.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to know about your take on Rust and Bones. It's one of the anticipated movies I'm waiting for. It's being foreign. I'm hoping that it'll get a lot of distribution and a lot of notice here in the States. Marianne, I can't pronounce her last name.
Cotillard.
Yes, thank you. Her performance in May VM Rose was fantastic. I'm assuming and have heard wonderful things about this one. And the premise is kind of odd. She's a whale trainer, and a dramatic happens to her. And so I was wanting to know if you've seen it.
Yeah, she has a tragic killer whale accident, actually. I have seen it, and I'm starting to sound like a broken record. I think this has been a good year for movies. I think this is a great film.
This may be the first year that you guys have been here at the end of the year and said, boy, there was a lot of great stuff.
Yeah. Well,
normally we're complaining about stuff.
That's partially because Christopher Kelly is sadly not with us this year, and he's on his Australian sojourn. This is a movie that in some ways actually reminds me of Silver Linings Playbook, although it's not a comedy at all. It is a melodrama, but it's so well done. It's a just very finely etched melodrama, if there can be such a thing. It's another unlikely love story. It operates at just a fevered emotional pitch. The director is Jacques Audiard, made one of my favorite films from a few years ago called A Prophet, which was a nominee for Best Foreign Language Film. And I think this is the best performance that I've seen Marion Cotillard do. And that's saying quite a lot, given her track record, including an Oscar for Vivian Rose.
And she spends most of this movie in a wheelchair, is that right?
In a wheelchair legs? And just with amazing, great digital effect of basically removing a character's legs. And you don't even think twice about it. You don't say, wow, that looks kind of funny. Where are her legs? You feel like you are looking at a woman who has, in fact, lost her legs. And it's the truth to it, visually, what you see on screen is just remarkable.
So she doesn't do it like Tim Conway, where she just like kneels down on her knees and walks around on her shoes?
Oh, is that Dorf?
Dorf. That's too bad.
Thankfully not.
It is funny that in this country we sort of pat ourselves on the back when we see a film in a foreign language, whereas for the rest of the world it's really common to consume things that were made elsewhere and not in their original language.
That's true. Though, to some extent, Hollywood has colonized the rest of the world at this point. I mean, there are few countries whose native cinemas outperform American movies at the box office. I think that's kind of sad. I think there are still some great national cinemas. France, of course, South Korean movies tend to do very well in South Korea. They really support their indigenous cinema, but that's more of an anomaly than a rule, unfortunately.
Well, and what I would say about foreign films is think about the number of gatekeepers that movie had to make it through from its native country to being played at, let's say, the Angelica or the Magnolia. A lot of people had to say yes to this movie to get it in front of your face. Mm-hmm. And to me, I kind of like that idea, like, man, this maybe there is something here. Otherwise, who would take the risk of releasing this foreign language film that not a lot of people are going to see, most likely? Someone really believes in this, or a lot of people really believe in this, so maybe it's worth my time.
And the other French picture this year is Amour.
Also just fantastic. This is the first movie I saw when I got to the Toronto Film Festival this year, and as soon as I left, I knew it was the best movie that I would see at the Toronto Film Festival. It's tough to watch. It's about an old couple in France. The woman is not well. She's played by the great Emmanuel Riva. And it's just a very unflinching drama about getting old. And it's very finely observed on a moment-to-moment level. And it just hits like a gut punch. It's not a happy movie by any means, but I think it's a remarkable feat. Filmmaking definitely going to be on my top 10 this year, as will Rust and Bone. So those are just two great French films to look forward to.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Christy, calling from Plano. Hello, Christy.
Hi. I'm just calling because I wanted to know, do you think movies like The Master are going to get lost with all the other movies that are coming out this holiday season?
It's a good question, actually.
I don't think it's going to get lost because I think the two main performances in it are going to both be nominated. Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix are just fantastic in this movie. It's one of the, you know, there are some movies that you don't fully understand and it drives you crazy, and then there are some movies that you don't fully understand, but the fact that you don't understand it almost makes it more interesting. And I think The Master falls into the latter category. I don't think I could map it all out for you, but I do know that when those two guys are on the screen together, I mean, I could have watched that, you know, for as long as they wanted to run it.
I like The Master a lot. I know people who love movies and know movies who really don't like The Master and read my review. I gave it an A, and they basically said, what did you see in this movie that made you give it an A? One thing it has against it, I think, as far as mainstream appeal and maybe awards consideration, it stubbornly refuses redemption. Mm-hmm. It stubbornly refuses any kind
of... Or even a climax.
Yeah, or even a climax. I admire that. I really sort of enjoy... I understand why redemption is important in storytelling, but when I see a fairly major movie that defies those rules so brazenly and it's done so well, like The Master is, I kind of stand up and applaud.
I admired it as an exercise, but then it also did occur to me why movies are so formulaic. On the one hand, it made me think a lot about that. And on the other hand, I felt like you, Stephen, that I thought the performances were astonishing, but I didn't quite know... I couldn't decide even what to make of the performances because when the film was over, I wasn't sure what I was supposed to think or what I thought.
I'm looking forward to seeing it again. One thing to point out about The Master, we don't talk a whole lot about soundtracks and scores, but this has one of the best soundtracks that you'll ever hear in a movie. It's by the great Johnny Greenwood, who is the guitarist for Radiohead, who does all of P.T. Anderson's movies. It's very densely scored, and I mean, it just, I think it really, the point of a score should be to underscore, obviously, the emotions and feelings and action, and this one does it to a T.
You just wanted to get a Radiohead reference
yes.
in there.
That's my goal.
All right, done. We have Stephen Becker here from KERA's Art and Steak and Chris Wagner with the Dallas Morning News. They are also co-hosts of the weekly podcast, The Big Screen, which you can find at artandsteak.net. We'll come back to our conversation of movies in just a few minutes. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephen Becker is here from KERA's Art and Seek, along with Chris Wagner of the Dallas Morning News. You can go to dallasnews.com or iTunes to find the weekly podcast that they co-host called The Big Screen. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Hitchcock sounds so interesting. I don't think of Alfred Hitchcock as a particularly romantic figure, but I've been really interested in these relationships. What are your thoughts?
It's very enjoyable. It's not particularly deep. It's a sort of a superficial look at the making of Psycho. Anthony Hopkins is fun. He's under some pretty heavy prosthetics. It kind of tries to tack on some gimmicks. I mean, for lack of a better word, to tell a story. It's based on a great nonfiction book by Stephen Rebello called Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho. For some reason, the movie finds it necessary to have Hitchcock chatting with Ed Gein, the serial killer that Norman Bates was based on. It has a sort of semi-romantic subplot involving Alma, Hitchcock's wife. I didn't think that worked very well, but as a story of a collaboration between husband and wife, and Alma was very important to what Hitchcock did, and is just a fun behind-the-scenes look at a movie that I frankly love. I think, you know, many, many people Worship Psycho. I think it works on that level. I think it's worth seeing, especially for fans of Hitchcock and for Psycho.
Yeah, I would make sure that you've seen Psycho first. And if you haven't, I mean, that'll certainly make the movie a lot better. I agree with Chris as far as the best part of the movie are when you see Hitch, as he's known in the movie, and Alma, his wife, working together, because you really get the sense that as much of a genius as Hitchcock was, and I really subscribe to that theory, you know, even geniuses need sounding boards. It doesn't all just come out of your head. And there are some really just fantastic scenes where you see the little touches that Alma brought to Psycho that really made it the movie that it is. There's one in particular. Hitchcock has this grand idea of killing off his leading lady, Janet Leigh, in the first hour. And he runs that by Alma, and she says, well, you know, it would have a lot more impact if you did it in the first 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's what one of the things that Psycho is known for is, you know, people couldn't believe that Janet Leigh, the big star of the movie, is gone in the beginning of the movie. But that was the kind of little touches that Alma added to Hitchcock's movies. So if you're a fan of these kind of like behind the scenes Hollywood stories, I think you'll get a lot out of Hitchcock. I like to tell people it's sort of funny because this is a movie that's based on a book that's based on a movie that's based on a book. So there's a lot of material there to get through, but I enjoyed it a lot.
We should say that on the podcast this week, we have a Hitchcock blowout. We talked to Stephen Rebello, author of that great book, and also Professor Rick Warland, a Hitchcock specialist at SMU.
I am curious to see Bill Murray as FDR.
I am too. I hear the movie is not great, and I have not seen it, so I can't say that it's not good. I didn't hear great things about it at Toronto. But yeah, of course, Bill Murray, FDR, who doesn't want to see that? That sounds like fun.
It played the Lone Star Festival out in Fort Worth. And yeah, I think it just depends on if he plays it super straight or if he gives you a winking Bill Murray nod. I think that he probably has to play it straight because it's not particularly funny subject matter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Whitney in Dallas. Hello, Whitney.
Hi. I wanted to ask your guests how they feel about Life of Pi. I just saw it a couple days ago, and I fell in love with the imagery. I haven't read the book. I bought it when the movie came out, and then I decided I was going to read it, but I wanted to see the movie while it was still in theaters. So I just wanted to ask how you feel about it.
I am like you in that I really did fall in love with the imagery. It's one of the coolest looking movies that you'll see. And I, you know, a lot of times people will tell you, oh, that's good, but you know, you could wait and see it when it comes out on DVD. This is kind of the opposite of that, in that I feel if you're going to bother to see it, you really should see it in the theater. And I would even pay, and I'm not normally an advocate for 3D, but I would say it's worth paying the extra couple bucks and getting your glasses and seeing it in 3D, because there are some spectacular moments in this movie. One of the ones that always comes to the top of mind is a lot of it takes place out on the open ocean, just in a boat with this kid and a tiger. That's kind of all you need to know. There's a scene where these flying, a giant school of flying fish are flying over the boat. And it, you just feel like you are on this boat as these fish are coming by. And it really is. There's so many just, how in the world did they do that kind of shots? That being said, the story itself, after you get past the artistry of the, you know, those kinds of shots, it's really, to me, was just kind of about a guy on a boat out at sea, which is, if you were in that situation, that would be kind of boring. And I think it was kind of boring for me as a viewer. So it's,
there well, the was novel so internal.
Yeah, I guess. And, you know, a lot of people said this was the unfilmable novel. I think partly because, like, how do you film a boy and a tiger in such close proximity, which they really did figure out how to do that very, I mean, it's done. The kid and the tiger are not really in the boat at the same time with the way they filmed it, but you would never know that looking at it. I know a lot of people who, you know, really connected with it on that second level. I mean, Roger Ebert raved about this movie partly because of that, but I don't know, man, just after the scenery stuff, I just didn't really, the story didn't grab me. I don't know what you thought.
There's some spiritual underpinnings going on here. This is largely a movie about spirituality and faith, and those underpinnings just didn't work for me. They didn't connect to me. So that said, I will agree with you, Stephen. It's the best looking 3D movie since Avatar. It's really the only 3D movie I've seen since then that kind of makes you step back and say, wow, 3D can actually really enhance a viewing experience beyond just making you spend a few extra bucks and have some blurry action in the background, or maybe, you know, a knife sticking out through the screen. The depth of the visuals in this movie is just astounding. It's a beautiful looking film, but I have to say that emotionally and intellectually, it didn't do a whole lot for me.
I don't want to spoil anything for the 14 people listening who have not read the novel, but at the very end, there's some very sort of magical realist scenes in the novel. Do they look good on film? And surely you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. My problem with the ending, and I think, some of that stuff works well. There's also a big reveal at the end of the novel, which calls some of the action into question, that, mm-hmm. you know, things that have gone on the boat. I think they really botched that in the movie. And I have not read the novel. I'm one of those 14 people, actually.
It's really good.
I'm sure it is. So I have not read the novel, but I have heard that this moment that I'm speaking of, that I will not spoil as we talk, I hear it works well on the page. And to me, watching it on film, it just kind of made me scratch my head.
And, you know, you mentioned all of the kind of like spiritual underpinnings in the novel. I think if you go into the movie having read the novel, those things might be more present for you because you come in expecting them. If you're not familiar with the story and you just go see the movie, your head's not in that space where you're going to be looking for those cues. So I imagine it's a very different experience for people who have and haven't read the book.
What about Flight for people who are just looking for something exciting?
I think it's a good movie. Denzel is one of the great actors, and he can do this kind of role in his sleep by now. But I think he brings a little bit more to this as well. He's a really sort of vulnerable, tough guy. It's really a movie about an alcoholic, and that we don't really see that in the trailers that much. We see that he has some problems. We see that he's a pilot.
So is most of the movie the aftermath after this big thing?
Okay. Yes, and I should say the actual plane incident that kicks the movie off is astounding. I was grabbing the back of my chair in fear.
I've been told that's possible.
Yes. So that stuff is great. Denzel's great. I think it's a solid movie. I think there's a little bit of hypocrisy to what it's trying to do because it also has spiritual underpinnings, by the way, which for me worked better than the ones in Life of Pi. It's about a guy really trying to find the truth in himself and to be honest. I think it works on that level. But then you have moments and scenes with, for instance, John Goodman as the good time buddy drug dealer guy, and he struts in with the Rolling Stones playing in the background. You're like, wow, this guy's fun. He's Mr. Party. And then it kind of switches to this very serious moral quandary that the Denzel Washington character has. I think there's a sense of wanting to have your cake and eat it too, to Flight. But yeah, I think it's a really good movie, and it's nice to see Robert Zemeckis making a live-action film after he's kind of been in stop-motion mode for the last several years.
You know, this has also been a really good year for John Goodman. We haven't mentioned Argo yet, but he has a supporting role in Argo, which I think we really will be hearing about when all the, you know, end-of-the-year awards stuff, starts to roll out. It's been nice to see guys like him who we've known John Goodman for 25 years now, and when he gets these really nice parts, particularly like in Argo where he plays this a real guy who was a sort of a movie makeup magic guy, I don't know, it's just nice.
He's actually really good in Trouble with a Curve, also the Clint Eastwood baseball movie. He plays sort of an old wise baseball scout, kind of Clint Eastwood's buddy. I think he's actually quite good in that too.
And I know that you guys have not seen any of the kids' movies for this year, but it doesn't seem like there is much this year, not as much as usual.
I keep hearing there's good animated films. I am guilty to not seeing enough of them. I hear Wreck-It Ralph is a lot of fun. I hear less glowing things about Rise of the Guardians, which is one of the worst movie titles I've ever heard, by the way. It's the one about Santa Claus being kidnapped by the Boogeyman and the Tooth Fairy and other heroes, including the Easter Bunny, coming to rescue Santa. So I just am sort of deficient in my animation watching this year, I'm sad to say.
I think because there wasn't a big Pixar. I guess Brave.
Yeah,
Brave was
Brave.
Out this summer. So, and that, didn't quite wow people the way, I mean, the bar has been set so high for Pixar, it's almost impossible for them to top themselves. So I think normally, you know, they own the animated category. It may be a little bit more up for grabs this year. Back on the Oscar talk again.
Okay, Tarantino, back this year, new film?
Yes.
Django Unchained. I can't wait to see it. I mean, in a nutshell, this looks like Quentin Tarantino, Mr., you know, genre perversion, twisting movies around, doing a blaxploitation spaghetti western with Jamie Foxx, Christoph Waltz, who won an Oscar for Inglourious Basterds, Leonardo DiCaprio playing a evil slave owner. I guess it could be a train wreck, but I just don't think it's going to do anything halfway. And from the trailers, I'm frothing at the mouth to see it.
Well, and the basic premise of the story is Jamie Foxx, Terrell's own, plays a freed slave who's on a mission to go free his wife, who is still, you know, somebody's slave. You know, that's the perfect setup for a Tarantino movie. I mean, you want to talk about revenge. That's all. I mean, what could be more, you know, revenge and just sort of score settling than that storyline? And also, from what I understand, as all of his movies do, it has just an unbelievable collection of songs for the soundtrack that I'm sure, even though they're going to seem weird watching a Western and seeing a, like, there's a Rick Ross song in there, I'm sure it will work perfectly.
And there's that great trailer with James Brown's The Big Payback, mm-hmm. which just makes me so excited.
How could that not be good?
So I don't think I've talked to you guys on the air since we found out that George Lucas sold the Star Wars properties to Disney. Do you each remember the first thing you tweeted or said publicly
I was very, very cynical and dubious about it. I still sort of am, but I'm becoming more of a moderate. A couple of people have pointed out to me that Lucasfilm in itself and its pre-Disney identity really was not doing good work. And perhaps at least this shift to Disney, which has been doing pretty good work since the Pixar people took over, maybe this will breathe some life into the Star Wars franchise. I always, for Star Wars, I'm of that generation where I just feel like you're messing with my childhood when you do something like this. Let Sleeping Dogs Lie. I thought the last three movies were, for the most part, atrocious.
I only could see the first one. After that, I had given up because I wanted the three kind
that
of crystallized.
That was the worst, by the way, Phantom Menace.
Was it?
Yeah, it was about taxes. It just wasn't very good. So my first reaction was, yes, large corporate behemoth takes over sort of imaginatively bankrupt franchise.
There's sort of a parallel there with the, you know, the four,
yes,
or whatever.
The evil empire.
Yes.
But now I'm actually starting to be very cautiously optimistic.
I don't know how they're possibly going to make back that huge investment that Disney put in it. But, you know, the first thing everyone said is like, oh, my God, Disney's going to screw up the Star Wars franchise. And as you said, I mean, George Lucas has been screwing up the Star Wars franchise. So what? I mean, why are you worried?
Yeah, it couldn't get much worse, could it?
I don't think so.
All right. Well, happy holidays, guys. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you very much for having us.
Chris Wagner writes for the Dallas Morning News. Stephen Becker is on staff for KERA's Art and Seek. They are co-hosts of the weekly podcast, The Big Screen, which you can download for free at dallasnews.com or at artandseek.net or at iTunes. Once again, it's been great to have you guys. Thanks.
Thank you.
Anytime.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Download the podcast and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think. Any comments, questions, or suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.